KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Good morning. Chinese consumers are spending less on things like dining out, and China and the United States are in the middle of a trade war. How does this look to international business people? We'll listen on Morning Edition from NPR News. Canada faces demands from the Trump administration. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin, which is one reason why Prime Minister Mark Carney is calling for new elections. Can he strengthen his party's hand in dealing with the U.S.? And Senator Bernie Sanders is drawing crowds as Democratic voters say they want their party to do more to push back against the president's policies. It is Monday, March 24th. On this day in 1945, Nat King Cole's King Cole Trio took the top spot in the very first Billboard pop chart. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli military has struck a major hospital in southern Gaza, killing a senior Hamas official. Gaza health authorities say a teenage boy was also killed. This is one of the latest Israeli airstrikes that have killed more than 600 Palestinians since Israel broke a ceasefire last week. NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza.
The Israeli military struck one of the last functioning hospitals in southern Gaza. The military says it was targeting a senior Hamas figure inside the hospital. Hamas says the official had been receiving medical treatment at that time. Gaza's health officials say the strike set fire to part of the hospital, wounded hospital staff, and killed a teenage patient. It came on a day of intensive Israeli bombardment, which sounded like this. Health officials said six members of one family were killed. They were sleeping in the tent. This is part of Israel's strategy to pressure Hamas into releasing hostages under terms that align with its own interests. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza.
This afternoon, a federal appeals court will take up President Trump's appeal to block a lower court judge's orders to release information about recent deportation flights. U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg wants to know why Trump used a wartime power to deport hundreds of migrants when the U.S. is not at war. He wants to know if the government violated his orders to stop the flights. President Trump has bashed the judge in online writings. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi says she thinks the U.S. Supreme Court will have to step in.
These judges are out of control. We are going to fight back, and we are going to win. And the Supreme Court will be ready to hear these cases.
She spoke to Fox News. The wife of Vice President Vance is scheduled to travel to Greenland this week with President Trump's National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz. Greenland is a territory of Denmark. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports their trip comes as President Trump continues to push for the U.S. to take control of the world's largest island.
Bosha Vance will travel to Greenland with one of her children and a U.S. delegation on Thursday to visit historical sites and learn about Greenlandic heritage, according to the White House. They'll also attend Greenland's national dog sled race. Waltz will separately visit a U.S. military base in Greenland this week as well, according to a White House official. The visits come as Trump has continued to say the U.S. will acquire the territory, despite leaders in Denmark and Greenland rejecting that. The territory is rich in natural resources, and Trump says the U.S. needs it for international security. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks are sharply higher this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 1%, or 480 points. The Nasdaq is up 326 points. That's about 1.75%. You're listening to NPR. British authorities are questioning the officials of London's Heathrow Airport. It shut down for 18 hours Friday after losing power. There was a fire at a nearby substation. But British electricity officials say the privately owned airport had other power options. Heathrow is a major airline hub that connects continents. Tens of thousands of passengers had their flights disrupted. A jury in Georgia has found international company Bayer liable in a case involving its weed killer Roundup. The jury ordered Bayer to pay more than $2 billion in damages to a man who claims the weed killer caused his cancer. Comedian Conan O'Brien received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor last night at the Kennedy Center. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports comedians who were there joked about O'Brien and also about President Trump's recent takeover of the Kennedy Center.
John Mulaney said he first became a fan of Conan O'Brien's, watching him on TV when he was 11.
You showed me how a bizarre Catholic man who presents well but is deeply troubled on the inside could navigate the entertainment industry.
Other comedians who paid tribute were Nikki Glaser, Adam Sandler, Sarah Silverman, Tracy Morgan, and Will Ferrell. And a number of them made jokes about President Trump ousting Kennedy Center leaders and ending up chair of the board himself. Conan O'Brien said that accepting an award named for Mark Twain was a responsibility.
Twain wrote, "Patriotism is supporting your country all of the time and your government when it deserves it."
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. More people are traveling here to China than there were a few years ago. The government has been encouraging visitors in a bid to fire up the economy. Our team saw the difference when we arrived at the Beijing airport.
I'm just remembering that when I've come in recent years, I've come on half-full planes. This is just a lot busier than we've seen.
Absolutely. The plane was packed. We're here waiting on the platform for the train to take us to the main terminal. It's a sea of people.
That's our editor, Rina Advani.
Okay, here we go.
We didn't make it onto the first train that arrived and tried for the second.
People with one foot on and one foot off.
We eventually made the third.
This is really wild.
China is trying to rebalance its economy by boosting consumer spending. It may be getting tourists to pay, but not so much its own people. Many avoid optional purchases like going out to eat. And when I met some friends for dinner here over the weekend, we were the only customers in that restaurant. Low demand has led to low prices, as we saw when riding a car using China's rough equivalent of Uber.
The ride today is apparently 80 yuan. I'm just looking up how much that is in dollars. And it is approximately $11.
It seemed on the low side for a ride all across the city. Good for us, but not so good for the driver.
It's just pocket money, so...
Our producer, Alan Cao, interpreted as the driver said this is his second job. He works for an import-export business, which made money shipping medical supplies to the U.S. during the pandemic, but has struggled to keep up with a changing economy.
Before, every month, I might have 300 orders from the United States entering China, and now, if I have 30 orders, I would be happy.
Wow, that's a big change. Today is Monday, he says. I don't have much work and I'd just be sitting at the office, so I'm driving. He asked us not to use his name because his colleagues and family don't know. China remains the world's biggest manufacturer and exporter, a great industrial power, as we could see from the skyscrapers and stadiums we were passing in the car. The government is working to boost consumer spending, too. But the U.S. trade war adds to the pressure, which we sensed when we attended an annual conference that China holds here for global business leaders. It's called the China Development Forum. The entry hall for this forum is filling up with people, mostly in dark suits. One wall of this room is decorated with the traditional Chinese painting of birds and nature. And the other three walls are decorated with placards showing major brands that do business in China, including American brands like Otis, Pfizer, and American Express. American CEOs attended, among them the heads of Apple and Federal Express. China's premier, Li Qiang, the number two official in the government, delivered a speech in front of giant screens that were lit up red. And he portrayed China, not the United States, as the stable nation that is following the world's rules. He spoke of rising instability and called for open markets. China's been saying that a lot. While the premier never said the words United States, tariffs, or Trump, the references were hard to miss.
Falling back to the law of the jungle will be a regression in history and a tragedy for humanity.
The people listening included Jens Eskeland. He's based here in Beijing for the European Union Chamber of Commerce, representing many European companies.
There were comments also about the global situation and how China is sort of a source of global stability, committed to the rules-based global order, a proponent of free and fair trade.
5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would have been the United States talking about the rules-based international order and saying that China wasn't really practicing free trade.
Yes, and I think you're right in that observation.
Some people at this forum say China still doesn't practice free trade. Michael Hart represents U.S. businesses for the American Chamber of Commerce in China.
China does say that it is open for business and other places are not, but we know that there continue to be both opportunities here, but also restrictions on foreign companies doing certain kinds of business. So you could say, for example, technology. There's certainly areas where U.S. can't participate. Telecommunications, finance, agriculture, there continue to be restrictions.
Business people here face parallel problems. They want to do business in a country that is increasingly focused on its national security. And the United States also is increasingly focused on its national security. At this forum, we met one of the business people who say they are caught in the middle.
I'm Duane Kwong. I'm the founding managing partner for a venture capital firm called Qiming. We primarily invest here in China in healthcare and technology.
He grew up in China, was educated in the United States, and worked in Silicon Valley. In 2006, he started raising money, often in America, to invest in Chinese firms. He had plenty of takers at first.
Our international investors were completely convinced, sold, committed.
You didn't even have to sell it for a while.
You don't even have to sell it.
More recent years were different.
One is, you know, the Chinese economy has hit a very significant headwind and growth stalled. And obviously the other aspect of it is geopolitics. It starts creating a lot of uncertainties and start questioning the viability of continuing to invest in China, whether it is still politically correct.
There are some American investments specifically in technology that the U.S. government has explicitly banned or discouraged.
Correct.
Is it hard to get investments even for areas that are not banned or openly discouraged?
That's a great question. For the longest time, as long as it is strictly and truly and confidently within the law, it is okay. Investors will feel comfortable that you would not get me in trouble.
Now he goes to a U.S. pension fund or university endowment and finds fund managers who don't want to risk criticism.
They may choose not to have the hassle of answering to these very difficult or impossible to answer questions.
When you talk about American investors worried about political correctness, what about investors from other countries who are thinking about China?
Less so, but on the other hand, America has huge influence to its neighbors.
Do you feel personally torn at all, having so many connections to the United States, having done so much business there, to see the two countries in
in competition or conflict in this way?
I am totally torn. It's not just somewhat torn, because I love both countries. I was born and raised here. I spent many years in the U.S. and have extended business networks and roots in both societies. But it is the political correctness of, you know, whether or not, even though the law allows it, whether or not a U.S. company should be welcome or U.S. investors should be welcome into a Chinese company, a Chinese deal. That type of political correctness bothered me for a long time on the China side. I never thought that would also be coming from the U.S. side as well. The law is the law. If the law allows it and you're not doing anything, you know, terrible, then it ought to be able to happen. But right now, you know, both sides are tit for tat. That's certainly not something I like to see happen.
Now, Michelle, the annual forum where we met Duane Kuang is itself a subtle example of rising tensions. It's an event to encourage global dialogue. Traditionally, it's been a place where Americans might stand up and tell Chinese communist officials what they think. But longtime participants say that in recent years, the discussion has become more managed and a little less open than it used to be.
Steve, I have so many questions, but I'm going to keep it to two. Your last guest there was talking about a climate of fear. Is he saying there's a climate of fear in both the U.S. and China?
Yeah, he's making that comparison. He's suggesting the two places in that way are the same. Now, we shouldn't take this too far. It's not like the United States is a closed society. You can't say anything. There's a lot more freedom in the United States. But there do tend to be global trends of different kinds, including global trends of freedom. China was a freer place 10 or 12 or 14 years ago. It felt freer. People felt more open. People felt more able to speak out. There still is some room to speak out in China, but it's become narrower and narrower over time. And basically what Duane Kuang is suggesting, that as a frequent visitor to the United States, he senses less freedom in the United States for people to say what they want and also to do what they want, particularly when it comes to investing in China.
And, you know, to that end, how easy or hard is it to tell how the economy is doing when there is not a free press as we would understand it, even considering all the concerns that we do have here in the United States about, well, the scope of discussion seems to be sort of under some attack. But how do you know there how the economy is doing?
Yeah, they're are some challenges. There's a lot of information. Of course, the economy is so important that people gather enormous amounts of information. The government gathers enormous amounts of information. Sometimes economists that I talk with feel they have to squint at the data a little bit to try to figure out what's really going on. They don't necessarily trust everything, but the information is there. And then what we try to do as journalists is go out and check things. We were in a meat market just earlier today. You go out and you talk to people and you try to compare the stories of ordinary people like that driver that we spoke with the statistics that you get and with the economic analysis of the statistics, and you do the best that you can over time. It's an imperfect situation, but you do what you can.
So really interesting. We are going to hear more from Steve and our NPR team in China in the days to come. Steve, thank you.
Glad to do it.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, legal scholar Elie Mystal talks about the 10 laws he says are ruining America. In his new book, Bad Law, he argues that our country's laws on immigration, abortion, and voting rights don't reflect the will of most Americans, and we'd be better off abolishing them and starting over. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Steve is reporting from one country that faces U.S. tariffs. Here is news from another. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is calling for a snap election. He's doing that a week and a half into his job. Canadians vote for a new legislature, which Carney says the country needs to face threats from the United States.
President Trump claims that Canada isn't a real country. He wants to break us so America can own us.
We've placed a call to hear more about this from Canada, and where Danielle Melon directs the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
Why so soon?
Well, Mark Carney is not an MP. It's the first time he will actually run for elected office in Canada. He recently became leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. And in Canada right now, we have until yesterday, we had a minority parliament. And so it means that the Liberals needed support from at least one other party to stay in power. So instead of returning to parliament, and the set date was actually today, elections were triggered yesterday. So the parliament was dissolved, and now we have elections, and in a very short campaign of about 5 weeks.
So he's hoping to get a majority. He's hoping that his party will have a majority so he won't need to have a coalition government. Is that right?
That's right. In Canada, at the federal level, we don't really have coalition governments. But certainly he wants to have a majority government. Otherwise, if it's a minority government, he needs support from at least one opposition party, maybe more, to stay in power.
So what's likely to be the central issue of the campaign? Is there one?
Yes, I think that Canada-US relations, the trade war, and even the integrity of Canada as a country, I mean, sovereignty and the identity of Canada are certainly on top of mind of the agenda, alongside cost of living issues and broader economic issues. But these are related because, of course, the trade war has profound economic implications.
So it seemed, though, his Liberal Party was on the back foot, right? Correct? Until Trump spoke up, would that be accurate?
Yes, I do think that what the president has said and done has really helped the Liberals in the polls. You know, when Justin Trudeau announced his resignation on January 6th, the Liberals were way, way behind the Conservatives in the polls. And now they are neck and neck. And according to the most recent seat projections, the Liberals will probably have the upper hand. If the elections were held today, of course, there are still 5 weeks of campaigning, and campaigns do matter. But yes, so far, what President Trump has said and done regarding Canada has helped the Liberals.
Before we let you go, as briefly as you can, in terms of policy, is Carney very different from Trudeau, his predecessor?
He's moving the party towards the center. I think that he's less progressive in terms of social policy. So the focus is really much on the economy and on making Canada stronger. That's his slogan. And the slogan of Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party and the Conservatives, is Canada first. So a lot of nationalism or patriotism, if you want, at the center of this campaign.
That is Danielle Bailon. He's the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. Mr. Bailon, thank you so much for joining us and sharing these insights with us.
You're most welcome. Have a wonderful day.
Last week, we brought you a story about doctors and clinics that prescribe abortion medications from a distance and mail them across state lines to patients in states with strict abortion bans. In that story, we said incorrectly that Maine Family Planning and its medical director mailed pills in this way to other states. It does not. Maine Family Planning only mails abortion medications within the state of Maine. The first black woman elected to Congress as a Republican has died. Mia Love represented Central Utah from 2015 to 2019. KUER's Sean Higgins reports on her life and career.
The daughter of Haitian immigrants, Love was born in New York and raised in Connecticut. It was there, while in college, she met her husband, who was on a Latter-day Saint mission. They moved to Utah in the late 90s. Love's political career began in the small city of Saratoga Springs, Utah, where she became the first black woman mayor in the state. During her first run for Congress in 2012, she described her politics this way.
A lot of people have tried to put me in a box somewhere, and as everybody knows, I'm not easily put in a box. I hope that that message that I have of fiscal discipline, limited government, personal responsibility resonates from Tea Party all the way over to moderate.
Utah Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, a close friend, said while Love may have achieved many firsts, she never let them define her.
She understood that she was breaking barriers and that she was first in a lot of those things, but she herself never leaned on that. So when people called her a rising star, it wasn't because she was a black female Republican, it was because she was really talented.
In Congress, Love was a reliable conservative vote and served on a House panel that investigated Planned Parenthood. In Congress during President Trump's first term, Love did not shy away from criticizing him after he used an expletive to describe Haiti and developing countries in Africa. Love said the comments were racist and called on Trump to apologize. Here she is in the audiobook of her 2023 memoir.
To have a president of the United States of America who seemed incapable of having relationships, only convenient transactions, mock you after a tough election loss, or call your ancestral home a can be devastating, disconcerting, and disappointing.
After leaving office in 2019, she worked as a political commentator at CNN. Love was first diagnosed with brain cancer in 2022 and publicly shared it a year later. Mia Love was 49 years old. For NPR News, I'm Sean Higgins in Salt Lake City.
This is NPR News.
For many, places of worship are also places to feel safe. They're a refuge. However, the Trump administration's hawkish stance on immigration has faith leaders and their congregations worried.
What are the plans if ICE does knock on the door right now?
Well, that's what I'm feverishly trying to figure out.
I'm Elsa Chang, how religious leaders are dealing with the threat of ICE raids on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. For the first time in weeks, Venezuela has accepted a flight carrying migrants deported from the U.S. NPR's Carrie Khan says more than 200 deportees landed in Caracas this morning.
The Venezuelan deportees were first sent to a U.S. military base in Honduras, where a Venezuelan airline picked them up for the rest of the trip to Caracas. Direct deportation flights have yet to begin, but this was the first time in weeks that Venezuela has accepted the return of its citizens. Maduro had stopped receiving deportees after President Trump pulled a license allowing Chevron Oil to work in Venezuela. Trump then sent more than 200 Venezuelans to a maximum security prison in El Salvador. U.S. officials also threatened more sanctions against the South American country. Maduro has accused Trump and El Salvador's president of kidnapping the Venezuelan deportees and demands their return. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
The British government is ordering an investigation into Friday's closure of Heathrow Airport in London. A fire at an electrical substation knocked out power to the airport for about 18 hours. Roughly 1,300 flights were canceled. The U.S. Supreme Court is rejecting an appeal from a death row inmate in Texas seeking a new trial. He was convicted of fatally stabbing a teenager in Austin. This is NPR News. Members of Congress are returning to Washington, D.C. after a week back in their home districts. NPR's Barbara Sprunt says some Democratic lawmakers got an earful from their constituents about pushing back on President Trump's efforts to downsize the federal government.
I heard a lot of other people ask, is there a plan? And it really doesn't seem like there's a plan.
This question from a constituent named Amanda during a town hall in Golden, Colorado, was one of many asked to Democratic Senator Michael Bennett about what Democrats can do to push back on the GOP agenda. 19-year-old Jackson Armenta said it's personal.
Yeah, I have family that's on Medicaid. I have family that collects Social Security, and they need that to survive month to month. And so we just really want to make sure that there's a real plan.
Bennett acknowledged Democrats are limited in what they can do on Capitol Hill as members of the minority party, but said mobilizing ahead of next year's midterms will be critical to put a check on the Trump administration. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
AAA says the cost of regular gasoline in the U.S. has risen 5 cents a gallon nationwide over the last week as more refineries make the switch to summer blend gasoline. It's averaging close to $3.13 a gallon. Stocks are sharply higher on Wall Street this morning. The Dow is up almost 500 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing, China.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Delegations from the United States and Ukraine have begun talks in Saudi Arabia to try to achieve a ceasefire in Russia's war with Ukraine.
Ukraine's defense minister called these conversations productive. The Americans meet the Russians next. So far, both sides have agreed to stop targeting each other's energy infrastructure, although Ukraine's president says that is far from a genuine ceasefire.
We're going to go now to NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, who is in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. Eleanor, hello.
Good morning, Michelle.
So you've been talking to people in Kyiv, people who are just trying to live their lives. Do the people that you've heard from think that these talks could produce a real ceasefire?
Not really, because no one believes that Russian President Vladimir Putin really wants to stop the war. And frankly, the proof of that is all around them. On Saturday night, Russia launched one of its biggest drone attacks yet against Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. And I was cowering in the bathroom as this battle went on for over an hour in the skies. And I stuck my phone out the window. Here's what it sounded like, Michelle. You know, that's the air defenses shooting down the Iranian Shahed drones. But they were overwhelmed and some got through. There were fires all night. 3 people were killed, says the mayor of Kyiv, and dozens wounded. I went yesterday to an apartment block near the river that was hit by a drone and where an older woman had burned to death in her top floor apartment. And people were gathered out front. Everybody was looking up. The apartment was blackened. The roof and ceiling were gone. Windows were blown out all around, and there was a lot of damage to the building.
Wow, that sounds terrible. What do Ukrainians say? What do they tell you about these ongoing attacks, even as the ceasefire talks are taking place?
Yeah, well, they say these attacks just sort of make the talks a farce. I spoke with a 19-year-old law student, Tatiana, who was at the building. She didn't want to give her last name, but she pulled up a video on social media of the woman on the top floor's death, and she asked me to share it with Americans.
And this is a part of the video of the screaming. And this is burning. So, like, if you can show it in your country and to tell what is happening, just see what is going on, just see how we live in this reality.
You know, she says she wants to show Americans who say they're sick of the war that we're sick of it too, and they're exhausted by the continued and constant attacks from a country that invaded them 3 years ago.
And remind us, what is Ukraine pushing for in these talks?
Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky wants to broaden the ceasefire to include other infrastructure. He spoke last night. Here he is.
Потрібно також більше тиску на Росію.
And he basically says, you know, everybody, the U.S., Europe, the world needs to put more pressure on Russia to stop this terror. And Zelensky said after the last meetings in Saudi Arabia, where Russian President Vladimir Putin would only agree to stop targeting energy infrastructure, that it should be clear to everyone that Russia is the only one who's dragging out this war.
And what is Russia expected to ask for in these talks?
Russia will demand that Ukraine cede swaths of territory that the Russian army doesn't even fully control. Russia wants the West to end all military aid. Europe says no way on that. Russia wants Ukraine to majorly scale back its military. These are maximalist demands, one analyst told me, and they're not acceptable conditions for Ukraine. But to even be able to sit down and talk face to face about it, Ukraine says the nightly attacks on its cities must end.
That is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
Even in China, I've noticed this news from the United States. Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds to rallies around the country, rallies that he bills as a fighting oligarchy tour. Sanders supporters say they're frustrated by President Trump's agenda and by the Democratic Party's response. NPR's Stephen Fowler followed the independent senator to a rally last week near Phoenix.
Everybody, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders' fiery economic populism that denounces the political influence of billionaires and corporations isn't new. It also hasn't always been easy to explain.
Well, when I talked about oligarchy, I think over the years, I think for some people it was an abstraction.
But there's something different here, now, 2 months into President Trump's return to office in 2025.
People understand. You have to be blind not to see that we have today is a government of the billionaires, by the billionaires, and for the billionaires.
How you doing, ASU?
Last week, Sanders kicked off a Western swing of his fighting oligarchy tour with rallies in Las Vegas and Tempe, Arizona, joined by New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Our political system is ill-prepared for this kind of abuse of power. In fact, much of our political system enables this kind of corruption, starting with the role of money in politics.
The pair spoke to a crowd of thousands that flowed into and spilled outside of an arena at Arizona State University, railing against Elon Musk's role in cutting federal spending and pushing agencies to fire workers. Sanders spoke directly to the president, telling him his actions so far harm American voters and the government.
We're not going to allow you and your friend, Mr. Musk, and the other billionaires to wreak havoc on the working families of this country.
Democrats don't hold Congress or the White House, but Ocasio-Cortez told the crowd that there are still ways to push back against policies they don't like.
People are starting to put the pieces together. And ironically, the most divisive forces in this country are actually starting to bring more of us together.
That said, there's a lot of anger directed towards the Democratic Party, too. Recent polls show the party's popularity at an all-time low, driven by voters who want their elected officials to more actively counter Trump's agenda. Voters like Clarissa Vella, a volunteer at the Arizona Sanders rally.
They need to show their faces every way they go, and they're going to be so exhausted. But at the end of the day, if we want to take back our democracy, that's what we got to do. No war was ever won by sitting on your couch. You know what I mean?
Vella says Democrats need to, quote, stop biting their tongues and get loud about their plans and spring into action.
So they need to organize themselves. Because that's all the only way this is going to work. They don't have the House. They don't have the majority. So they need to push back as a wall.
That wall has some pretty big cracks in it, especially as congressional Democrats can't seem to agree on how to handle Trump, Musk, and the DOGE push to remake the government. For his part, Bernie Sanders says Democrats have a choice.
They can continue to stay as a party which essentially turns its back on working families. Spends the time raising money, going to their inside the Beltway consultants.
Or they can capitalize on this moment by championing policies that address things like income inequality, health care, and climate change.
If they do that, I think working people will come back into the fold. If not, I suspect the party will continue to decline.
One thing that's not declining, interest in his message. This weekend, Sanders drew more than 30,000 people to a speech in Denver, larger than any event during his two presidential runs. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Tempe, Arizona.
This is NPR News.
Host of the podcast Scam Inc. says social media, AI, and cryptocurrency have turbocharged a multi-billion-dollar scam industry. Next time, here and now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Go
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. You know that PBS show where people bring in some knick-knack, they don't know what it is, and then an expert comes in and says, hey, it's this valuable thing? Well, a school in Australia had this big rock sitting in the foyer. Somebody heard fossils had been found in the area, so they called a paleontologist, and lo and behold, what looked like chicken feet was actually footprints from dinosaurs from 200 million years ago. And you thought your grandma's old clock was cool. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. America's class clown was roasted last night at the Kennedy Center. Conan O'Brien received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. It was a celebration of O'Brien by his peers at a time when the Kennedy Center probably needed a good laugh. NPR's Elizabeth Blair was there last night, and she's with us now. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
So just remind us, how big of a deal is the Mark Twain Prize?
In the comedy world, it's a huge deal. It is the premier comedy event. It's all about comedians showing love and respect for their own. And every year, the A-list turns out to pay tribute to the winner. So on stage last night for Conan O'Brien, you had people like Adam Sandler, Will Ferrell, Nikki Glaser, Tracy Morgan, and John Mulaney.
It's an honor to be here at the Kennedy Center, or as it will be known next week, the Roy Cohn Pavilion for big, strong men who love cats.
Roy Cohn was a notoriously ruthless lawyer who President Trump took advice from, and Cats is one of the musicals Trump said he wanted to come to the Kennedy Center. Mulaney was mocking his takeover of the institution, as did a number of comedians.
To remind people, Trump is now chair of the Kennedy Center's board. Why don't you just remind us of how that happened?
Right. About a month after he took office, he ousted the president of the Kennedy Center, the board chair, and board members who were Democratic appointees. And Trump's new board voted him chair. And it was a major shakeup because the board had always been nonpartisan, and now it's not. In response, a number of artists have canceled shows, including Rhiannon Giddens, as well as a production of Hamilton that was scheduled for next year.
What was the overall tone of the evening?
The tone was varied. It was silly, like a lot of Conan O'Brien's sketches and characters. There was political satire addressing the moment, and it was like a roast. Sarah Silverman and Conan have known each other for decades.
Even after I lost my first and only job in show business, Conan kept having me on, like, all the time. And each time was just such a magical experience, you know? Like a first date with someone who's so funny and so charming that you kind of trick yourself into thinking they're hot.
So Trump's takeover really did not overshadow Conan's night. And by the way, President Trump was not there, nor was Vice President Vance.
Interesting, because I'm wondering about that. So when O'Brien accepted his prize, what did he have to say?
He made lots of jokes. He also talked about how it was an honor to be presented the award by David Letterman, because before his career took off, one of Conan's dreams was to write for Letterman. And he talked a lot about the writer and satirist Mark Twain. He said accepting an award in his name was a responsibility.
First and foremost, Twain hated bullies. He populated his works with abusers such as Huck Finn's alcoholic father, Tom Driscoll and Pudd'nhead Wilson, and he made his readers passionately hate those characters. He punched up, not down, and he deeply, deeply empathized with the weak.
So he took kind of a serious tone at one point in his acceptance speech. And afterwards, he was joined by Adam Sandler and a bunch of white-haired Mark Twain impersonators, and they did a rendition of Rockin' in the Free World. The show streams on Netflix beginning on May 4th.
That is Elizabeth Blair. She's a correspondent with NPR's Culture Desk. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Money is not always in our genetic code.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bank of America. Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The home genetics testing company 23andMe has filed for protection from its creditors. It hopes to sell itself and keep operating. Now, there's a lot of very personal data in there. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has details.
23andMe is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This type of bankruptcy allows a company to reorganize and keep going without being liquidated. 23andMe uses saliva from its customers to test their DNA. It says the tests show whether clients are prone to various diseases, including cancer and Alzheimer's. In a statement, the company says it filed for bankruptcy to facilitate a sale process and intends to keep operating, adding that it's, quote, committed to continuing to safeguard customer data. Last year, 23andMe settled a lawsuit alleging it didn't adequately protect that information. Millions of its clients' data was stolen by hackers. In a post on X, CEO Ann Wojcicki says she's resigning and intends to submit a bid to buy the company. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A headline in the Wall Street Journal suggesting President Trump could delay tariffs on cars, trucks, and microchips and some other goods is bringing some cheer to stock investors this morning. The Journal says auto companies and some other sectors will not get the tariffs on April the 2nd, at least. And the Dow is up 545 points, 1.3%. The S&P is up 1.6%. The NASDAQ is up more than 2%. President Trump today upped the pressure, at least rhetorical pressure, on the leftist government of Venezuela, saying any country that buys Venezuelan oil and gas will find itself with a 25% U.S. tariff. Trump is focused on immigration from Venezuela. Budget cuts and warnings of cuts to come are forcing big universities to make deep cuts of their own. This even as some of the budget slashing is running into court challenges. When it comes to medical research, universities plan years in advance. Marketplace's Nova Safo now on how financial uncertainty is affecting one research lab at Duke University in North Carolina.
Research that started 30 years ago at Donald McDonald's laboratory at Duke University led to a new drug in 2023 to treat metastatic breast cancer. Now he has a second drug in clinical trials.
Both of those drugs, let me just say, were drugs that industry passed on years and years ago for other indications, and they were rediscovered by really inquisitive, bright graduate students.
McDonald's lab depends on a handful of those students, funded in part through the school and in part through grants. Right now, with all the uncertainty around federal funding, McDonald is facing an unprecedented challenge.
This is the time of year when students elect, you know, to work with various professors. And I personally am scrambling right now to take four incredible students who want to work with me to develop a new drug we have for prostate cancer, and I can't find funding.
He needs $70,000 per student per year. Similar scenes are playing out across the country. Academics say at minimum the Trump administration is slow-walking approvals of medical research grants. Also, the threat of drastically reducing reimbursement for researchers' so-called indirect costs, things like electricity, supplies, has left many unsure about what money their labs will actually have to spend.
We're doing a lot of tabletop exercises, a lot of strategic planning exercises with different scenarios.
Colin Duckett, Executive Vice Dean for Basic and Preclinical Science at Duke, says those scenarios could mean broader school-wide budget cuts to come. Dozens of other universities have already publicly announced such cuts because of the disruptions coming from the federal government.
I came here 35 years ago from England because this is the best place in the world to do science. And it is really sad for me to wonder whether the U.S. is the best place to do science. It's almost inconceivable.
There is a lot of worry. There is a lot of frustration. There is a lot of anxiety.
Laurel Harbridge Young is a political science professor at Northwestern University. Her own research grants are unaffected, but she's been having a lot of conversations across academia and says graduate students in particular are concerned about their futures. That's because of the challenges professors like McDonald are having in finding grants. Existing private funds can't make up the difference for the federal government's vast financial powers.
If this grant money dramatically decreases or goes away in some fields, we can't sustain to bring in the graduate students. That means these early career researchers don't get to be trained to become world-class researchers and scientists. And we're going to lose that whole pipeline of expertise and knowledge.
A loss, academics say, which could take a decade or more to reverse. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Commvault. Businesses can recover data as well as cloud applications and platforms after a cyber attack in just minutes with Commvault, so they can become a continuous business.
Makes sense to pay for a house or a car in installments, but what about paying later for two slices of moussaka, a large Greek salad, and some baklava? The payment company Klarna is partnering with DoorDash on buy now, pay later loans for DoorDash deliveries. But also in these deliveries come convenience and some risk. Here's Marketplace's Henry Epp.
One of the most popular buy now, pay later methods is known as pay in four. Basically, when you buy a new pair of pants or soon a delivered burrito, you pay one installment up front and three more every 2 weeks, explains Joanna Stavins at the Boston Fed.
So it's a sort of six-week short-term credit, interest-free.
But if you're late on payments, fees can eventually rack up. Stavins says buy now, pay later users tend to have less money in the bank.
And they already carry credit card debt. So they are what I call financially fragile.
There's extra risk, says Nadine Chabrier at the Center for Responsible Lending, because unlike getting approved for a credit card,
there's no requirement for a buy now pay later to assess whether you have an ability to repay the loan. That may lead to consumers taking out unaffordable amounts of debt.
And a delivered DoorDash meal often comes with fees already, says Lisa Gill at Consumer Reports. So someone who uses buy now, pay later for their order is financing
service fees, delivery fees, gratuity fees, and any other service charges over a month's time, and they're just trying to get a $10 bowl for lunch or burrito for lunch.
You could, she says, order directly from the restaurant and cut out the middlemen. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
There's a $35 minimum on installment purchases for DoorDash. So no, you can't eat now, pay later on one burger. Unless it's like Japanese Wagyu beef and the truffle fries. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.